สุอาคาโตเยนะภะคะวะตาธัมโมสุปัตติปันโนยาสะสาวัคคสังโฆธัมมยังภะคะวันทังสะธัมมังสะสังฆังเอเมหิสักการะหิยตาระหังโรปิเตหิอาเปโปจยามาสาตุโนบันเดภะคะวะสุเจระนิพุตโตเปบาจิมาจันดานุกัมปมานะสาเอเมสักการะตุกัตตปันนาราโพตปติกันหาตุอัมหังคัมเดหะราตังอินดายะสังกายะอรหังสัมมาสัมพุทธังภะคะวะบุญธรรมภะคะวันทังปิวัติมิสุวะกะโตภะคะวะนะธัมโมธัมมังนะมะสามิสุปฏิปันโนภะคะวะโตสาวกสังโฆสังฆังนะมามิอันตมยัมพุทธัสสะภะคะวะโตอะพุพะภะคะนะมะคะรังโรมาสีนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะอันตมยัมพุทธัสสะปิตุติงโรมาสิตัมโกโยโสตตังอนโนอะระหังสัมมาบุญโทเวจจารณสัมปันโนสกโตโลกเวโตอนุตตรโรปุริสธัมมสารติสัตตาวมโนจานังพุทโธภะคะวาโยเวมังโลกังสันเทวกังสมารกังสัพพรหมกังสาสัมมณพรหมนิงปัจจังสันเทวมโนสังสยังอภิญญาปเวติสิยอนธรรมเดเสสิหาติกัลยานังมาเจกัลยานังเฮโยสานกัลยานังสารังสัพพยัญชนะเอวะละปะริปุณณังปะริสุณณังมัจจริยังปะกาเสสินามหังภะคะวันตังอะภิโภชยามินามหังธัมสิรัสสานะมามิอันตมยังธัมมาปิตุติงโรมาสิโยโสสวากาโตภะคะวันตาธัมโมสันเตติโกวะกาลิโกเอหิปัสสิโก วะปัญญโกปัจจตังเวทิตาปวะวิญญูหิธัมมังนามังธัมมังนามังสิรัสสานะมามิอันดามยังสังฆาปิตุติงโรมาสิโยโสสุปฏิปันโนวัภังกวะโตสาวัคคสังโฆโหจุปฏิปันโนวัภังกวะโตสาวัคคสังโฆนิยายปฏิปันโนวัภังกวะโตวัคคสังโฆสาเมจุปฏิปันโนวัภังกวะโตวัคคสังโฆยันเตนัมจันดาลิปุริสโยนิยตาปุริสภูกัลลาเหสะภังกวะโตหุนัยโยวาหุนัยโยดังอินัยโยอัญจลิรณีโยอนุตรังบุญญาเฮตังโลกัสสะธัมมังสังฆังปุจจยามินะมังสังฆังสิรัสสานะมามิปัญญากันดารโอมังอันโนเวนนาโนสัญญาอันโนสังอารานโนวิญญาณังอันโนวานนายันนานิวายันนังโรปายันนามนายันนามงานายันนามนายันนังหันนายันนามจิวายันนามรนายันนามยายันนามบอดาบายันนามยันนามธรรมายันนามตาตุโยจังกุตาตุโรปนานุจังอวิญญาณนุโนนนานุนานานานุโนนวิญญาณนานุนานุขันนานุงานุวิญญาณนานุมะทานรันนานุชิภาวิญญาณนานุยานานุภาวนามนานุกายวิญญาณนานุมโนนามนานุมโนวิญญาณนานุมาอนินทรียานิจังอนทรียามโทอนินทรียามทรียามมินทรียามมนินทรียามทินทรียามมรินินทรียามเจวินินทรียามสังหินทรียามดงทรียามสุมนาเนทรียามนอมนาทรียามโมเพงินทรียามทินทรี manindriyam nindriyam manindriyam mananyananya namindriyam nanyana driyam nanyana driyam jana rayarayana nyaninongam narayana nyam Ariyata nyam dung anirona ngamini Dung anirona ngamini badibanam Avijja bhajaya sangara Ngara bhajaya vinyanam vinyana Nama rupang nama rupa pachaya salayandanam Yandana pachaya paso pasa pachaya vedana vedana Tanha tanha pachaya upadanam upadana Chayam bhavo bhava pachaya jani jani Chayam jaram maranam so angam barinde vantung adom manasubhaya Sambhavandi eva metta sanghe valasadunga gan Sasamudayo hondiya vinjayanda vinva anenda viranga nirona Ghara nirondo sangara nironda Jnana nirondo vinyana nironda nama Nama rupa nironda dalayandana nironda Yandana nironda pasa nironda masa nironda Dana nironda vedana nironda Nirodo dhamna nirodo ngopada na nirodo Dhana nirodo bhava nirodo bhava nirodo Di nirodo jadi nirodo nyaramaranam Aparinde vandunga domana nubhayana Jandi eva medha sanghe valasa Kangandasa nirodo hoti
Questions. Appreciated your suggestion that 80% of practice involves strengthening citta. Would you expand further on ways to do that? Well, I think at this time I was suggesting in the early days, particularly 80% strengthening. and seeing how, you know, when it's strong enough, it will, you'll know. Why does it need strengthening? Because citta, say primary awareness, heart, subjective center, a sense of being something, you know, which is always connecting onto various objects, which he finds doesn't quite fit. You know, trying to personalize what can't be personalized, that's one of its habits. Trying to own and claim and control something it can't. So this is pretty stressful. It gets pretty tired out doing that and just keeps going because it desperately wants to find something to rest in. So it builds these concoctions. So that's ignorance. Ignorance, avidya, dependent on that is the building of concoctions, sankhara. This percolates into the way, into leading our consciousness to into such modes of seeing and experiencing things. This is the first links, dependent origination. But if it is strengthened, then it's a possibility it doesn't do this. It knows its own strength. You know, its own strength becomes a refuge. So finding something that it can settle into. This is rather imaginative and figurative language, but that's the way I'm addressing this. Because at least you get something out of it. you know, it's not classical, perhaps Buddhist language, but you get an exhortation out of it. And furthermore, you need strengthening because just that's the standard model. But then on top of that, the stress of doing all this seeking and searching and aggregating your experience and being stuck in all that and not getting the fruitful results, which takes a lot of energy. Then also in your daily life, depending on who you are and what you're doing, there's the added weight of pressure, work pressure, pushing. So citta also operates through intention, through volitional qualities. That's how it issues forth. So when those volitional qualities are ramped up, then the energy of volition is being used. So you're running your life on these volitional actions. So all that takes energy. So everyone gets quite depleted because what you're putting energy and effort into does not give your citta the feedback to nourish it. It generally gets money in the bank, puts the food on the table, gets you a pair of shoes, puts gas in the tank. Great, but that's not really doing your citta much good by itself. You know, because there's no recycling. Energy is not going back into the citta, it's all going out. So it gets very stressful. That's even one is living in fairly fortunate circumstances, let alone, you know, because citta is also that which is affected. It feels, it perceives. So when we're in a situation where we're perceiving distress, greed, hatred, delusion cascading around us and is storming samsara, this itself is like shell shock to the citta. You know, it's quivering with anxiety and despond. So all that doesn't do you a lot of good. And apart from whatever else is going on in terms of your health or friendships or divorces or deaths, which also take their toll. Oh dear. So I always come to these things, oh my God, what's going to come rolling through the door, you know? It's like, oh quick, intensive care unit. I'd sooner err on that side, then just imagine everybody's really in the pink of health and ready to strive on with diligence. So this, anyway, but even without all the, one would say, the modern stress factors and the, and not just the stress, but also the removal of regenerative factors, such as, living in a field of loving kindness and being befriended and having one's stress relieved. So living in relationships which are nourishing, which aren't always, isn't always possible for everyone. So these would definitely be of some support. So with this, then one's jitta is really quite stressed and undernourished. But it always needs some strengthening, just because of the power of the sense consciousness to pull energy out. Even in the best of circumstances, energy is pulled out through the sense doors. And so there's a depletion effect. And there's also energy gets used up in constantly generating a personality to manage this whole ongoing thing. So that takes some work to do, to keep it on steady keel. So if things really go bad, then the personality starts to get dysfunctional and so on. So strengthening citta, they're really waiting for looking at this. One is, one, first of all, we stop damaging it. So we protect it by virtue, so that we're living in some healthy atmosphere rather than, getting intentions and volitions going out that directly create toxic effects, like destructiveness, hatred, corruptness of various kinds, abusive behavior. So all these will have negative effects on citta. So good is not just being socially approved of, it actually is a bright energy. It's not just a social judgment, but it's something bright. It's called bright karma. It's brightening, gladdening, it's nourishing. And the opposite, dark, it clouds, it pollutes. So one is really just to cultivate that. And to not just to cultivate it, also to keep bringing it into attention that you are doing this. Because it's like you put the food down on the dog's dinner bowl, and you don't, and the dog doesn't eat it. The dog doesn't get nourished. So you've got to keep bringing the dog into the, look, there's your food, eat that. Stop sniffing out the door. Go and eat this. Stop chasing monkeys up the tree. Go and eat your dinner. So it's like citta has to also be directed to virtue, not just that we're doing it, we're also consciously recollecting. So this act of recollection is definitely one way in which we both protect the citta from eating poison or eating junk food or just whatever, but then eating good food. So recollection is virtue. We also recollect refuge, Buddha, awakening, truthfulness, Dhamma, Eightfold Path. Think these things through, and think them with a mind that uses thought to just to point to what the heart, where the heart is at. Say, is this true? Are you one who tells the truth, or try to tell the truth, or at least try not to avoid lying? Are you someone who does that? What's that quality in yourself? No, everybody doesn't do that. It's very obvious, lots of people don't do that. What is that? This is the quality of Hiriyotapa, sense of shame and sensitivity. That's beautiful, take that in. So one recollects virtues. One recollects virtues in oneself and in others. You know, so even other people's virtues, you feel inspired and lifted by that. Association with good friends is another way of strengthening citta, because it can absorb, you know, the calming, the warming, the friendliness, the purity of other beings as well. So it's not even in do it yourself. Of course, doing it yourself is part of it, but certainly that will amplify the effect. So taking refuge and constant and recollecting these things frequently, recollecting one's values and virtues, and bring them to mind. Why are they valuable? What makes them so valuable? It's not just an idea. Yeah. And can you get it? Where you get it, the get it bit, that's citta. Thinking it is just a mental activity, but getting it, that place where you go, oh, that's citta. That bit that gets it. Yeah. And so that's the bit we're looking for, not just verbiage. So this directing of citta is the function of wisdom. To say, you know, this should be followed, this should not be followed. Go this way, don't go that way. Wisdom is the guide. So the more one cultivates this kind of wisdom, then that will definitely lead to protecting citta and pointing it to the right kind of nourishment and strengthening. So use banya, wisdom. We can use the wisdom of those we respect. Yeah, we model, and then, you know, so you pick it up. This is called wisdom we've derived from others. Then we start to use our own, you know, savvy gut knowledge, heart sense of, no, it doesn't feel right. The more you can do this, as citta first was like a baby, you have to just keep popping things into its mouth. And then as it gets kind of a bit wised up, it's got its own, it starts to get its own intelligence. And, oh yeah, don't do that, do that. And this is really the thing, the citta is coming a bit more into line. Avoid obsessing yourself with unwholesome thoughts, unskillful thoughts, blaming thoughts, critical thoughts, sabotaging thoughts. If they happen, shun them, put them aside, don't give them any room. Protect yourself from the poisons that we inherit, these sabotage programs that cut us down. I don't know why, but it's true. Humans do this a lot. Anyway, so then the samadhi, so banya, and so where does this begin? So these two very strong features of strengthening are the qualities of called samadhi and calming and steadying and metta. So one, you're dropping the citta into an increasingly fluent and comfortable embodiment. You keep putting it in there, into an increasingly open, accessible and comfortable embodiment where it gets held, feeling warm and safe and steady and energized by natural bodily vitality, the breathing in, breathing out. And so if we want to see there's a tremendous fruit in this, the Buddha recommended this process and cultivated it, and when he was enlightened, he still kept in it just because it was a good place to be. Mindfulness of body, we call it, in brief. So this first of all means getting to a body, finding a body, because it can be the case one has almost lost it. You know, into the virtual. So just getting and working on getting a body that the mind was, the chitta will sit in. So you've got to steady it, open it, exercise it in obvious ways, in subtle ways, and then start sweeping through it. You know, what's this? What's this? Is this open? Is this shut? Is this painful? Is this, how is this? Till the body becomes more smoothly opened and accessible. And that's a cultivation in its own right, in which many, there are different systems. One is the system of the elements, where you contemplate body, this experience of embodiment in terms of earth, firmness, fire, vitality, light, heat, water, cohesiveness, the ability to embrace and harmonize in the body, air, the pushiness, pushy energies moving in the body, breath, energy flowing through the limbs. And space, sense of openness within the body and around the body. And to bring these in harmony, mean you begin to try to pick that up. This also requires wisdom. This may be too subtle. So if that isn't ready yet, you just begin to sweep your attention through your body from the crown of your head down to the soles of your feet. Just sensing how do you know you have that? What's there? This is going to make the chitta much more both acute, attentive, because what's there is not the same. Your head is not the same as your chest, not the same as your belly, not the same as your leg or your fingers. So you're just exploring the obvious sense. Yeah, this feels more resistant, this feels more mobile, this bit feels more cool, or doesn't feel very much at all, quite numb. It's tingling, vibrant. So you're exploring these sensitivities as you sweep your awareness, because jitta in this sense is awareness through the bodily experience. And in doing that, the likelihood is, if you do it in a sensitive way, that the body begins to relax and you can go deeper. Now this is, to cultivate like this, you must remember, you know, I would liken it to, say, grooming a horse, for example, is a phrase I use. So you start with the horse's ears are quite delicate, and the mane, and then the main body. So how you sweep has to be depending on what you're sweeping. So it's not just like cleaning a car, you know, you sponge the whole thing down like a machine. You know, it's the head, it takes some time. A lot of sensitivity there, very delicate. Be careful. This is a sensitive, very highly triggerable area. Lots of nerves, lots of activations there. And then you're sweeping down. And so you can even sense beyond what you might ordinarily imagine, difference between a knee, like a solid bone, and your eyes, very different parts of your body, aren't they? And so the quality of just careful attention is responding to what you're sweeping over. So it's not mechanical. And even within that, you might find you're sensitizing down through your chest. There's that feels really quite, you know, stuck, there's a tension there, or something seems to be jumping. So as you begin to detect energy patterns in the body, and then linger, pause. And my recommendation is, when you find somewhere that feels stuck or tense or in some way inflamed even, you just soften. You don't want to press, soften, expand. So the way you train your chitta to respond is rather like a careful medic or a healer who's tracing, and they come to a very raw place and they just do very lightly and linger, just sending goodwill. into the body, something like this. So this will both makes the citta much more acute and attentive, because that's, you know, what you're doing. And so citta, in terms of its intentionality, becomes more refined. It's not just like sweeping the floor, you know, bom, 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 but be careful. So your intention becomes much more supple and flexible and responsive. And what happens is, if these processes and practices are carried out thoroughly, that a lot of energy tangled up in the body begins to soften and release. And it's tangled up because of pressure, tension, stress, compactedness, distorted postures, and so on. So the releasing of the compacted energy in the body makes the body a much more comfortable place, and citta begins to rest in that, because now it's open, it's available. And you notice, you know, hopefully, if you cultivate like that, in line with that, that what's going to happen over a period of time is what's going to come to the fore is your breathing is going to come to the fore, because the density of the body has diminished. It's quite light, supple. You haven't got heavy masses of stress and tension in it, so which then block one's awareness. So as that become, as the body tension and stress and compactedness or distortions lessen, then breathing in and out becomes more apparent as a constant sign. Then you can steady yourself in that, steady the citta in that. Be aware of that, follow that. And this is a subtle sign, but the beauty of this, as with anything in a body, if we're cultivating properly, is your intention has to get pretty acute to not push, to not just drift off, and just stay with, not to press in, not to try to make it do something. Yeah, but just to stay with and track it as if you're like someone reading a pulse. It's not up for you to change the pulses, to make them go faster or slower, or even to make the patient healthy. You just want to track the pulse, feel it. And that quality, you're dealing with a living system, it will start to respond. You know, when the body's intelligence senses that steady, calm, careful and agile attention, it begins to respond, it begins to release and settle and feel comfortable, and it calms. So then the citta then is receiving the qualities of its work. This is a positive feedback loop. You're putting some energy in, just like you do with anything, but you're getting a good feedback from it. And the energy you put in is not the business model energy. It's not the energy of drive faster, go harder, get it working quick as possible, come on, come up with the results. This is not the model. This is not the model. It's like the model of a caring healer. It's a more useful model. Or someone looking after an animal is a more useful model. You know, you're responding to a living system here. And relationship. So one learns a lot. Citta learns a lot. It learns and it is strengthened by the qualities of calming and strengthening and centering that the body brings, because now the citta has got something to cleave to, where it's not constantly spun out into, you know, extraneous phenomena, and particularly the tumbling effect of the thinking mind. Thinking mind will begin to calm down because the energy is not going into that. So this way the citta is refreshed, strengthened and steadied and feels happy. Abhipa modayang, thoroughly, completely gladdening the citta. One practices breathing in, breathing out. I mean, that's awesome, really. So that's gone on quite a bit, but also then practicing metta bhavana is really working on the intentional quality. So we might say the body acts as like a, you know, a thing that we can respond to and work with, and the brahmavihara act as training the citta to bring forth, to intend itself, to incline in ways that are gladdening, loving, and give again very positive feedback. So this, the four divine abidings, or the four measureless abodes, are inclinations of citta. Cetasa is the term, the inclinations of citta that give a very positive effect. Yeah. They remove the sourness, the fearfulness, the guiltiness, the regretting, the recriminations about oneself, and the, you know, arrows of blame that we can throw onto others. Yeah. So they have various qualities. Metta is almost like that which inclines towards nourishing. Karuna, that which inclines towards protecting. Healing, so it stands in the presence of pain and discomfort and sorrow and doesn't blame you for having them. It just transfers warm energy to those difficult places. Mudita, ability to appreciate, be gladdened by the good, by goodness in oneself and in others, by good fortune, by skillful results, by the good karma of others, by their good deeds, and by one's own. It's a holistic thing, so it's not just it's to oneself as to others, all round. And equanimity is the sense of widening to understand the nature of existence, nature of that which manifests is going to be up and down. That's what it does. We wake up, we go to sleep, energy rises and passes. We're in a world where there's unfortunate results. We have unfortunate results that we experience. We don't know why necessarily. And we have fortunate ones. The latent tendencies of towards greed, hatred, ill will, which is still resident in us. And there are tendencies towards strengthening, purity, barami, such as resolution, goodwill, virtue, truthfulness, and so on. So there's this mix, and we're just spanning all of that. And the theme in equanimity is just widen your perspective, take a little bit longer. You know, the down will swing up, and the up will probably swing down on some way. And yeah, it's humility to it, the ability to stand in the presence of one's humanity and never give up. So the equation for equanimity that I sometimes use is: nothing works, don't ever give up. So So this strengthens the citta. This quality then, chitta is called chitta vimutti, when this is pure, this is chitta visuddhi, purification of chitta, chitta vimutti, liberation of chitta. So the chitta is liberated from unwholesome intentions, unwholesome associations. It doesn't nest itself in unskillful, painful, afflictive formations. It doesn't settle there. It doesn't go there. It doesn't go towards harmful intentions. Instead, it dwells in its purity and its happiness. And this is the basis then for panya, vimutti. In that state, in that condition, or to the degree to which that condition is available, it's not always 100%. But the one strengthening, and in tandem with that, we see this is all just, you know, that which has become, formed, clarified, purified, is not self, it's conditioned. And there's a release from the conditioned. Panya vimutti. So that's what we can say. I mean, this is like the whole of Buddhism, really, so I might take a little bit of time with it. And that's not really doing it full credit. Relationship with citta, how can we best work with citta? Well, keep listening. You know, I mean, everything we're doing is going to be doing that. And just listen to what I just said. Any one of those you can pick up, you know, fundamentally it's going to be mindfulness, faith, energy, wisdom, concentration, purity of intentions. These are the things we just want to keep, you know, reiterating to ourselves and bringing to bear. And with these, a lot of these factors, the beauty of it is that they're not just situation specific. They are things that we could, once you get them implanted, you know, then the idea is you get these kind, you begin to establish a sort of a kind of whole trajectory of how citta works. And then your challenge is how you can start to meet things from those places, you know, as stuff happens, you know, whether it's on a fairly obvious surface level, you know, or in the depth of meditation. That's the beauty of it. When with wisdom one begins to see the conditioning causes that lead to strength and health. And these conditioning causes, such as faith, these what are called the indriyas, faith, energy, mindfulness, collectedness, and discernment. Yeah, you're seeing, well, in any given situation, can you be collected in what you're doing? Yeah. Can you be mindful of it? Of course, mindfulness is the one one's encouraged to cultivate. That means just bear it in mind, stay with it. Steady yourself on it, don't jump to the next thing. Stay with that, take it in, be discerning about it. And then you gain confidence. So one can then work with citta really, you know, as long as you're awake. Or some people even say you should try doing it while you're asleep as well. Relationship with citta to intuitive awareness. Well, I think intuitive awareness is, I think this is a phrase that Lumpur Samedo, I think he's the only one who's used it. And like many of Forest teachers, including myself, we coin particular phrases or terms that seem to make, you know, we found helpful or reminders to ourselves, often in non-classical jargon, but more contemporary language, give you a better handle on it. I think with this he was trying to, you know, riff on or open up the topic of sampajano, which is often translated as clear knowing or full knowing. And unfortunately, as you recognize, many of these Pali words and the English words are often rather more academic, so they tend to lift your intelligence up to your forehead, when actually a lot of the intelligence of the Buddha is happening, you know, a bit lower, heart down there. But we don't have the English language for it. So in trying to get precise English terms, we come up with terms that are perhaps slightly more academic. But I would say intuitive awareness of gut knowledge, heart knowledge, whether this is exactly what Sampajano means. But it's, you know, it means essentially operating, so not operating from just pure rationality, but something that's more deeply felt, which would be citta, sensed through citta, the punya that arises in the citta. You know, this doesn't feel quite right, this seems about right. And citta will begin to express that. It does. Often we override it. We don't listen. Often we're rushing past it. Right, rushing past our own wisdom, following information or programs. So this lingering, pausing and beginning to get gut sense, heart sense, what feels about right. This is, I would suggest, one way of relating this phrase. But of course it's not, you know, I can't really speak with authenticity about someone else's language, but this is what it means, that's what I get out of it. Let's take a few more. Could you say something more about the sacred? Sacred is something beyond price, and sacred is what's sacred for you. And you're going to come down to probably values, virtues that stand the test of time, stand the test of circumstance, something that lifts the heart, makes the citta illuminate, lightens the citta, brightens the citta, strengthens the citta. So recollecting virtues, values, abiding in them, you know, this is the sacred. And of course, in the time of the Buddha, they had a person walking around who just was it, you know, was walking value. And so there's a huge amount of conviction arose just from being around this person who seemed to model it, you know, something, Bhagawa, the blessed one, the rich one, the sacred one, the holy one, Tathagata, the one who's gone to truth, the truth finder. So many of these epithets of the Buddha are there, derived from what this person seemed to model, and they're extracted so that we can recollect them. And it maybe you don't get all of them, but you get one or two that lift. So part of the one of the features of a lot of Buddhist practice is just this, is devotional recollection. In most Buddhist cultures, a good amount of time would just be spent nourishing the citta by devotional recollection and feeling the uplift, the inspiration, and setting one's values in accordance with the sacred. People go to stupas and perform rituals in order to really live and embody and be and dwell in the presence of that. So it's not just an idea, it really is something people enact. Yeah, mantras, recitations, pujas, offering to shrines and images are all ways in which the sacred is taken from the conceptual into the heart experience and even into the body experience. And it's a celebration. And you see in the way that the if you read in the discourses how, particularly some of them, you know, the people would be trembling with joy when the Buddha spoke, or well, it is marvelous, it is, you know, truly marvelous, Lord, and so on, because it shook them. In the ongoing exploration of greed and aversion, right, they seem to be two sides of the same coin. Can one exist without the other? If they can't, why are they listed as separate? Oh well, yeah, I guess they certainly can combine, you know, greed, because if we don't get the results of our greed, we get averse. Yeah, so sometimes aversion is just frustrated greed. And because one feels averse, one gets more greedy, you know, because we feel soured and embittered and, you know, miserable and hated or something, or deprived of good feeling, then we get greedy. So they do work together. But of course, greed very much moves towards consuming an object, and aversion moves towards rejecting it or destroying it. So their actions are different. And similarly, the strategies by which one combats them or meets them is different. They have to be first known in presence, and sometimes that could be enough, just knowing and not responding to them. So this signal meets and doesn't catalyze an action. So we just meet the rising weight of hunger, and it's just that. So, you know, not to be followed, feel it, let it be there, move on, let it fade. So this is essentially, you know, citta experiences these fluctuating tides of inclination and disinclination. That's just how it is when we experience results of the programming of our lives. And when it gets crucial is when the mind, citta, makes a decisive take. Yeah, that's that. This is called manokarma, mental karma. That is, one's experiencing various, you know, inclinations and disinclinations, and then you size up, something seems to seize upon a particular tendency, and that's the mental karma. Yeah, when a particular tendency, it clicks into determined or decisive mode. Even before we said anything, we start to look, and the mind has now got the flavour of ill will or aversion. We look at ourselves with aversion, we look at others with aversion, we look at ourselves with hostility or whatever. So something has actually taken shape. And this is the mano faculty. Citta is all potentials, and mano crystallizes that into a decisive yes, and then starts to, you know, accumulate perceptions and energies that firm that up, and then naturally one experiences the results of that. So if we hold presence, that can be a way in which those tendencies are not allowed to light the fire, not allowed to crystallize, not allowed to form a decisive focus. If this is inadequate, or one finds himself forming a focus, then we have several options. One is if we just refrain from going any further with it, and we start to say, question the premise, like, this is doing me harm, you know. This is not taking me to a place where I'm getting better, but taking me to a place where I'm feeling worse. We question the premise, and that may be enough. Or this is unworthy of me. You know, I'm brighter than this. This is beneath me. So that could be enough. If it isn't enough, then we begin to maybe investigate the nature of the object or the scenario which is generating it. Is this true? Is this really so desirable? Or am I just making it that way because of the greed in my mind? Yeah. Is the object desirable in itself, or is it my greed that's making it though? Then you start to question like this. You know, is he really so bad, or is it just I don't like that particular piece of behaviour because it, you know, is the whole person so bad, or just that little bit? Well, that little bit and that little bit. And the other little bit as well. Then if it's to say, well, this person's got problems, then why make it my problem? If he is, you know, bad-tempered, insensitive, garrulous, opinionated and conceited, and so why should I make it my problem? And one can sort of rationalize it like that. And then maybe, so in this way you say, well, he does pat dogs, that's nice. So you focus on some aspect that you find is admirable, and you try to boost that one up. So because you realize you don't want this thing of ill will, however bad he is, you don't want the ill will capturing your heart. And clearly sometimes you just got to say, don't even look at it, forget about it. You know, this is just too hard, too wired, too triggering. So these are ways. Yeah. Essentially, you've got to slow the process down before the action takes place and investigate the roots of the action and the results of it, and ask yourself, you know, you have a choice here. How important is it? This is really important. The only one thing you can get out of this life is purity of heart. Nothing else is going to really... the only place you can defend yourself is in refuge, not through aversion. Taking refuge from aversion is the way to make yourself feel good, not by slamming people around. Signless, you mentioned animitta samadhi, signless samadhi versus nimitta samadhi, jhana. Animitta means there's no, it's really often developed from seeing things in the light of impermanence or seeing things in the light of anicca. If things are so fluid, and then there's nothing, no real concrete thing to focus on because things themselves are amorphous. So disregarding the thinginess, the sign of things, because the sign is a shiftingness, one becomes more aware of, you know, signlessness because you're not following signs. So your mind abides in, we might say, just in the knowing, you know, and maintains that as a place of stability, and is not concerned with the flowing nature of signs. And this, because this withdrawal tends to result in the very signs fading out. That is, phenomena begin to dissolve and become more amorphous and smoky. And so a strong animitta, you're not really experiencing much apart from a sense of boundlessness or spaciousness, which is a kind of subtle object. Nimitta samadhi means you have a particular sign, such as breathing in and out, that you focus on, and that sign will change. It becomes luminous or bright, and it's still a definite, yeah, something you can track. The word nimitta is a problematic one because different lineages hold it in different ways. Some use this thing called the derived sign, which comes from often from staring at a casino, where you get a particular point of light appears in your mind, you take that in, you dwell upon that. And some people get these internal nimittas spontaneously when they meditate. They get luminosities or things of this nature. Naturally, they're rather interesting because they're not of the norm, and one can become quite focused on those. And some people say you have to have one of these before you can get anywhere in meditation, in samadhi. But notably, the Buddha didn't say this, so one feels, well, maybe this venerable, that's true for him, but maybe other people, not, the Buddha didn't teach it, then, you know, well, good, enjoy. But particularly Ajahn Chah wouldn't give much people much lift on anything, actually. A great deflator. Break the trajectory of suffering and by knowing Vedana as feeling and turning away before it goes into Sankara formations. Well, the feeling, and then there's this impulsive reaction to that crystallize with it. That's certainly a way of cutting one of the links by which suffering, stress and compulsion builds up. Of course, it's not the end of the story, but it's very helpful to just break the momentum, because feeling is a very strong object that we can experience most any time. Yeah, so it's more a constant thing that you can keep referring to, and sensing how it affects one's moods or one's attitudes or one's actions, and just keep as a feeling. Of course, some feeling is worthy of following, so it's not that all feelings should not be followed. So, of course, this is where some Indian lineages, the ascetics, were very against feeling. They took a hard line against feeling. But the Buddha said, well, some feeling is associated with unwholesome states and some feeling is associated with wholesome states. There's a pleasure of wholesome states, there's a pleasure with unwholesome states. Some unwholesome states arrive through difficulty, and some unwholesome states. So he said, essentially with a little more refinement, you begin to sense the wholesome feeling, such as the sense of happiness or gladness or somanasa, delight that arises through skillful actions. This is a feeling to be followed because it leads to skillful mind states. But if it's to do with things that throw the mind out into the sense world or into self-glorification, then it's a feeling to be restrained from and observed. So we have to it's good to just break the compulsion, but then you investigate. Often, Dhamma practice is accompanied with uncomfortable feeling, painful feeling, realizing that suffering is not that happy an experience. But then is a wholesome mind state of strength, of faith, of coming to terms with things. Is that being realized? So it's most of these things don't have simple yes-no answers. It depends. I'm not going to cover them all, so I'm just going to take there's a few more questions in the same handwriting, but I would like to also to give someone else a shot. So someone's asking about breath meditation, 16 steps. How does this, can I get clarity of how this happens in the light of anatta, or non-self? So phrases like watch the breath, practice continuously, and make your sati faster and faster imply willfulness of a doer. This generates much confusion because I'm trying to let go. Could you comment on this? Well, yeah, as I say, because these phrases are in quote marks, it seems to be quoting either a teacher or a group of teachers or a particular piece of jargon that's being used, which perhaps in the context of how that has been presented had its validity, but I don't recognise any of these phrases from the Anapanasati Sutta. It does say, you know, one is thoroughly aware, but practice continuously. Yeah, that's true. Make your sati faster and faster is a strange thing. Watch the breath is a common misnomer. Because, again, it isn't said like that. It's to be fully aware of the process of breathing in and out, which is not quite the same thing. Notice we are very visually oriented, and quite a lot of this teaching is more tactile. You know, so you contemplate being aware in a more tactile sense. You don't watch the breath, you experience this pushing and swelling and flowing. I mean, look at the sutta itself, and you know, he's talking about knowing the body in the body and how the body experiences breathing out. You don't see it, you feel it. And some of the phrases to thoroughly, fully feel one's entire body refers to feeling it, not seeing it. But, you know, watch the breath is obviously a word of advice to give you some sense of, you know, stay with that. But the language carries nuances that may not be helpful. Naturally, you can't practice from anatta. Practice like saying, you know, how do you get that delicious taste? What's that going to do with building a beehive? Well, yeah. You know, if you build the beehive, then you get the honey and then you get the delicious taste. So anatta is the end result. It's a realization. But all practice is moderated through intention, cetana. But intention can go in a range of ways, and I think it's unfortunate if we just use intention as a kind of rev up as hard as you can quality, that you know, the stronger and the better, because intention can do many, many things. Intention can bless, it can step back, it can rest, it can open, it can cause soft qualities, it can, you know, we can incline in many different directions. And you've got to know the particular inclination that is most supportive for staying present with this living, breathing vitality. And it's going to be a blend of something that's, yeah, you know, it's got a certain sort of staying on track, there's a certain firmness to it. But if you're too gripping it, the thing's going to start to go, you're going to tighten up, and then you lose some of the beauty of it. If your body's too tightened up, your mind's too tightened up, you don't discern the subtle vitalities very well. You don't get the quality of happiness and pleasure. You can be too forceful. So one has to moderate intentionality. Yeah? And it's rather like you're touching a living system. So how do you touch that? Well, you find out from the system. It'll tell you if you listen to it. Like, you know, it's too fast. That's too hard. I can't feel it. So breathing teaches us mindfulness. It teaches us mindfulness. The subtlety of the hold. I don't know about faster and faster, but there's a certain acuity that is needed. A certain sensitivity to find the right blend, and when you need to be a bit firmer and a bit more spacious and so on. And in that these all these lines the Buddha gives, you know, you can see that the object itself is shifting, changing. So how one's intention to thoroughly gladden the mind. I mean, when you do that, come on, gladden it. Glad, 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 glad. You know, it's a fairly soft, expansive state to experience that. It's a gentle, encouraging quality. So that's an intention. You know, it's a subtle flexion. Now, in the doer of doing that, this naturally does help to shift the doer. The doer action, intention is part of it, but the more the intention becomes supple and relevant, the less the sense of the permanent doer, because the doer has to keep changing. And often one of the big changes is that is so important and really, you know, in line with stream entry, is that the personality system, you have to either change it or let it change, because it cannot do this process. It's too clumsy. It's got the wrong programs in it. And you've got to begin to operate from a different place, which is much less willful, much less, you know, socially conditioned, much less egotistically driven. But there's still intention. Intention from the heart. Okay, one more for tonight. And these other topics I might try to touch in on another time. Somebody talked about one teacher described the result of the turning of the wheel of Dhamma in the heart to be that the yogi is conditioned to get to Nibbana regardless or despite himself. You can stop worrying now, it was said. If that's the case, why did the Lord advise Venerable Chunda to meditate, or he would regret it later? And he wasn't the only one he advised. He advised everybody. Well, the phrase "turning the wheel of the Dhamma in the heart" is a lovely, you know, a lovely evocation, but it's more evocative than precise, I would say. So I don't know why the teacher. Clearly, not worrying is a good idea. Well, you can stop worrying, because worrying is not going to help. But one should, yeah, one it does. You don't get to Nibbana, just you don't coast there. So one should practice, be mindful, because why not? Do good, because why not? Purify the heart, well, why not? You know, what else is there to do? You know, you either purify it or you don't. Well, isn't it better to purify it? And particularly if it's a happy experience, which it should be, enjoyable experience that one feels ennobled by, even if it's hard work, still it's ennobling, then, you know, but don't do it from some kind of, you know, sort of stressed out state. Do it with a sense of joy. And then whatever the results, a sense of joy is worth travelling for. And working for, and practicing for. So that's enough for tonight. Thank you for your questions. So let's take a break and have another 30 minutes. Just trying to take in any of the things that have been said and putting them into practice.